Hi, this is Tony Bruschi. You're about to listen to our brand new podcast, Dark Side of Wikipedia. Being a brand new show, we need to let other folks know that this thing exists so we can keep doing it. I'd greatly appreciate your help in that effort by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, and I'm going to make it worth your while as well. We're going to give away a $200 Amazon gift certificate to one person who left us a review. All you have to do is leave that review on Apple Podcasts, take a screenshot of it, and then send it to me. Send it to review@darksideofwiki.com. So, again, to review, leave the review at Apple Podcasts, take the screenshot, and then send it to me. Review@darksideofwiki.com. That's the email address. Review@darksideofwiki.com. Very soon, I'll select one person to get that $200 Amazon gift card as a thank you for leaving that review and letting other folks know we exist. Also, be sure to share us on social media, let your friends and family know, and be sure to press that subscribe button as well as we get another great podcast off the ground. I hope you enjoy The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Was an unlicensed aluminum siding contractor the villain behind the murder of a mother and her two daughters in the summer of 1989? The murder would leave the community baffled and the police searching for answers. In the end, the alleged killer would hold to his innocence until his final moments. Today, we hear the story of Oba Chandler on the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Oba Chandler was an American serial killer who was convicted and executed for the June 1989 murders of Joan Rogers and her two daughters, whose bodies were found floating in Tampa Bay, Florida, with their hands and feet bound. Autopsies showed the victims had been thrown into the water while still alive, with ropes tied to a concrete block around their necks. The case became high profile in 1992 when local police posted billboards bearing enlarged images of the suspect's handwriting recovered from a pamphlet in the victim's car. Chandler was identified as the killer when his neighbor recognized the handwriting. This was the first use of billboards by law enforcement in the U.S. Billboards then became useful tools in searches for missing people. Prior to his arrest, Chandler worked as an unlicensed aluminum siding contractor. Against the advice of his attorneys, he testified in his own defense, saying he had met the Ohio women and had given them directions. Chandler said he never saw them again except in newspaper coverage and on billboards set up by authorities. Police originally theorized that two men were involved in the murders, but this was discounted once Chandler was arrested. Following his conviction, Chandler was incarcerated at Union Correctional Institution. During his 17 years of incarceration until his execution, he was notable for not having a single visitor. Chandler was executed on November 15, 2011. He wrote a last statement to prison officials that said, "You are killing an innocent man today." The statement was read at the post-execution news conference. In February of 2014, DNA evidence identified Chandler as the murderer of Ivalice Barreros, who was found dead in Coral Springs, Florida, on November 27th, 1990. This is an interesting story we have today, because there's a lot of back and forth. There's the man who claims he never did it, even up until death. And then you have new evidence that comes out after the fact, way after the fact. And we'll touch on that a little bit, too, in this. But a very unsuspecting individual. If you look at his like mugshots and such, he does. He looks like if you were to personify a late middle-aged aluminum siding man. This is who you'd expect to be showing up going, yeah, I'll get the siding up this weekend for you, and it'll be done real good and quick. You know, it's he looks very not serial killer-ish. Tony and Carol Hughes joining you today, by the way, for the dark side of Wikipedia.
And, you know, there are some people who do look like serial killers, but not all of them.
Yeah.
You know? And I want to hear this story, but sometimes, you know, people have secrets and they've done things you never know.
Yeah. Sometimes the most unsuspecting are the scariest. It's interesting because we talk about BTK quite a bit, but BTK, you know, once you saw BTK and it was, you know, Dennis Rader, and you knew that was him, and it was, you know, it's forever ingrained in your mind that this man is, you know, the serial killer. What I found interesting when I first moved to Wichita was there were so many men that were rocking the BTK look, I think inadvertently. Just like the hair, the glasses. There was a lot of guys that I thought around town really resembled Dennis Rader. And I don't know.
You know, we have a friend who they did a Dennis Rader.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it was for. It was a TV special.
I think it was on Discovery.
Yeah, I think it was Discovery. And our friend played
played BTK.
BTK in the special. And it was really hard to work with him after that.
He did a really good job.
Like, you look just like him. And, you know, I don't think of my friend having a serial killer look until after he played BTK.
And, you know, in real life, when he's not makeuped up and they had him made up to look like BTK, he really doesn't look like BTK. But when they had him made up, it was like, holy shit, he pulls off a good BTK.
I had a hard time looking at him for a while. Because he was really good as BTK.
Yeah.
And I did ask him, I'm like, did that kind of mess with your head? Like, you know, I write comedy plays. Like, I've written a zillion of them. I do tons of stuff with theater. I don't act, but I write. And, like, I just write lighthearted fun stuff. I can't imagine getting into character to play someone who's really dark.
Yeah.
In a real story. Like, that would kind of mess with your head.
I think it would. So are you telling me there's not going to be a fun-loving, vaudeville-esque story of BTK coming to a Wichita theater sometime soon?
Well, I'll think about that.
There's no BTK melodrama that's going to be coming out?
I mean, no. Actually, no.
What a theme.
Bad idea.
Yeah, I don't think that would fly very well. I think that might might not work out. But yeah, that would be horrible. But yeah, that was just something I noticed when I had moved there, was the amount of people that were kind of rocking that look. But it's all, you know, it's perspective. Once you're kind of viewing someone through a certain lens, it's hard to not see them through that. Again.
Well, now I want to look this guy up, because when you first told me the name of this guy before, because I don't know anything about this story, I'm going into this blind. But when you said Oba Chandler, I'm like, old timey guy?
Mm-mm.
And you go, no. But he sounds like somebody like in 1880, Oba Chandler moved to Red Willow County, you know?
Sure. It's got, like, that old name.
It sounds like a really old name.
It does. We'll keep jumping into his story and find out more about the story of Oba Chandler. Oba Chandler was the fourth of five children born to Oba Chandler Sr. and Margaret Johnson, and was raised in Cincinnati, Ohio. When he was 10 years old in June of 1957, his father hanged himself in the basement of the family's apartment. At the funeral, Chandler reportedly jumped into his father's open grave as the gravediggers were covering the coffin with dirt. Chandler fathered 13 children by 12 women, including two sons and two daughters who were placed for adoption. Chandler's youngest daughter was born in February 1989, between May and September 1991, concurrent with the police investigation of the Rogers family triple murder. Chandler was an informant for the U.S. Customs Bureau's Tampa office. Crimes and incidents in Chandler's life. When Chandler was 14, he began stealing cars and was arrested 20 times as a juvenile. As an adult, he was charged with a variety of crimes, including possession of counterfeit money, loitering, burglary, kidnapping, and armed robbery. He was also accused of masturbating while peering through a woman's window. In one incident, Chandler and an accomplice broke into a Florida couple's home, held them at gunpoint, and robbed them. Chandler told his accomplice to tie up the man with speaker wire and took the woman into the bedroom, where he made her strip to her underwear, tied her up, and rubbed the barrel of his revolver across her stomach. On May 26, 1989, Joan Jo Rogers, 36, and her daughters Michelle, 17, and Christy, 14, left their family dairy farm in Wilshire, Ohio, for a vacation in Florida. It was the first time they had left their home state. Authorities believe Joan became lost on June 1st during the return drive from Orlando to Wilshire and had decided to take an extra vacation day in Tampa. While looking for their hotel, they encountered Chandler, who gave them directions and offered to meet them again later to take them on a sunset cruise of Tampa Bay. Joan and her teenage daughters had left Orlando around 9 a.m. and checked into the Days Inn on Route 60 at 12:30 p.m. Photographs retrieved from a roll of film found in a camera in Rogers' hotel room showed Michelle sitting on the floor. The last photograph was taken from the hotel balcony and showed the sun beginning to set over Tampa Bay, confirming that all three family members were alive and had not left their hotel room as the sunset began. They were last seen alive at the hotel's restaurant at around 7:30 p.m. It is believed they boarded Chandler's boat by the dock on the Country Campbell Causeway, part of Route 60, between 8:30 p.m. and 9 p.m., and that they were dead by 3 a.m. the next day. Chandler may have used the fact that he was born in Ohio to lure them into feeling a connection to him. Chandler knew Joan and her daughters were not from Florida because he saw the Ohio license plates on their car. The victims' bodies were found floating in Tampa Bay on June 4, 1989. The first body was found when several people on board a sailing boat crossing under the Sunshine Skyway saw an object in the water. The second body was seen floating off the pier in St. Petersburg, 2 miles north of the first. While the Coast Guard were recovering the second body, a call about a third, which was seen floating 200 yards to the east, was received. All three female bodies were found floating face down, bound with a rope around the neck, and naked below the waist. Autopsies showed all three victims had water in their lungs, proving they had been thrown into the water while still alive. Michelle, who was identified as the second body found, was freed one hand from her bonds before she drowned. The partially dressed state of the three bodies indicated the underlying crime was sexual assault. Ropes with a concrete block at the other end had been tied around the victims' necks to ensure they died from either suffocation or drowning, and that their bodies would never be found. The bodies, however, bloated as a result of decomposition and floated to the surface. So, it's not ever a good idea to take up the strange man who gave you directions to go out on his boat for a sunset cruise. In a strange
town. You know,
that
theory is probably right, that he probably knew the area of Ohio they were from, connected, and they felt safe, which is just a bad idea.
Yeah.
I don't care. But it's just sad. That was our first big vacation.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that makes me so sad.
It's one of those things where
die like that would be so horrific.
Oh, God. That I,
so perfect.
Yeah, and then you have to wonder what went on the boat. You know, were they? You know, you have to imagine that. You know, some of them were aware of what was going on while this was happening, and then seeing, you know, one by one getting thrown off the boat, and Jesus, I mean, just the horror that those women went through.
Well, and then the whole like. There would be the horror and like the fact that you agreed to do this.
Yeah. The guilt that the mom must have been feeling at that moment of like, oh my God, what did I put the danger I put my daughters into? Yeah. Horrible, horrible situation. it's interesting because people, there's nothing wrong with relating to people when it comes to like origin and like where you're from. I do it all the time. If I meet someone who's from Wisconsin, it's kind of interesting to be like, oh, where are you from? And it's a very, you know, it's a kind of a cathartic thing. If you're in an area that you're not, where you're not originally from, but you're finding someone who is from that same place. But I always find it interesting and sometimes scary when it comes to like salespeople doing that. Because I've had that several times where it's like, oh, where are you from? Or I've been with my wife where someone relates to, she's from a very small town in Texas. And there's been so many times we're out somewhere at some store or something. And then the salesperson's like, oh, where about in Texas? And she says like, oh, I'm from there too. And they start like kind of, and it makes me wonder sometimes, like, are you really from there? Or do you just like know a little bit about there? Or have you learned about all these locations from doing this for so long that now, you know, the next person who comes in that says they're from Toledo, you're also from Toledo. You know, some people can be super slick that way and it's scary. But there's, of course, the genuine version of that. And then there is the, you know, I'll be from wherever you want me to be from to get my way.
And I just don't trust anybody.
Yeah.
Like, I have, you know, I'm a very kind person and everything, but sure, I don't trust anybody. Like, my friends, obviously, yes, but if I was to meet a stranger who's like, Kansas, I've been to Wichita before, well, yay. You know, I would be like, great, that's really awesome, yay. And then if he'd say, I'm going to take you on a sunset cruise later, I'd be like, F you, I don't think so. Leave me alone.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes.
And when did this happen again?
89.
I mean, I think people were a little bit more trusting then, but still.
Still. No.
Still.
Yeah. No. Let's continue on. Joan Rogers and her daughters were not positively identified until a week after their body's discovery, by which time Joan's husband and the girl's father, Hal Rogers, had reported them missing in Ohio. On June 8th, a housekeeper at the Days Inn said the Rogers family's room had not been disturbed and the beds had not been slept in. The hotel manager contacted the police. Fingerprints found in the room were a match to the bodies. And final confirmation of their identities came from dental records. Marine researchers at the University of South Florida estimated from currents and patterns that the victims were thrown from a boat and not from a bridge or dry land between 2 and 5 days before they were found. The Rogers car, a 1984 Oldsmobile Cialis with old license plates, was found at the boat dock by the Courtney Campbell Causeway. The case remained unsolved for over 3 years, partially due to the volume of tips received by police investigators. The biggest tip came from a Madeira Beach police bulletin that described a similar rape of a 24-year-old Canadian tourist that occurred 2 weeks before the Rogers murders. Chandler was arrested for the murders on September 24, 1992. His handwritten directions on the brochure found in Rogers' vehicle and a description of his boat written by Joe Rogers on the brochure were the primary clues that led to him being named a suspect. Local police posted images of Chandler's handwriting on the brochure on billboards in the Tampa Bay area, leading to a call from a former neighbor who provided a copy of the work order Chandler had written. This was the first such use of billboards by law enforcement in the U.S. Billboards became useful tools in later searches for missing people. Through handwriting analysis, the two samples were matched conclusively. Another of Chandler's neighbors and one of the secretaries on the investigative task force thought Chandler resembled the composite sketch of the suspect in the seemingly related rape case. A palm print found on the brochure was also matched to Chandler, who had sold his boat and left town with his family soon after the billboards appeared. In 1990, when the television show Unsolved Mysteries was about to report on the deaths of the Rogers family, Chandler and his then-wife moved from their home on Dalton Avenue in Tampa to Port Orange near Daytona Beach. Investigators originally thought two men were involved in the murders of the Rogers family. This theory was used for in an action show in a 1991 episode of Unsolved Mysteries. This theory was dismissed when Chandler was arrested. No evidence of a second man, other than a former prison cellmate's claim that Chandler said another man whose identity the cellmate claimed to know but would not reveal, has ever surfaced. The second suspect theory was believed by Chandler's approach of two Canadian female tourists that he was willing to approach multiple potential targets by himself. Hal Rogers' brother John was also considered a suspect, even though he was serving a prison sentence for the rape of a woman at the time of the murders. Police investigating the woman's rape allegations found evidence indicating John had also sexually assaulted Hal's daughter Michelle, although charges involving this assault were later dropped because of her reluctance to testify. The St. Petersburg Times said John may have planned the murder during a visit to his parents' property near Tampa a month before the murders, once the police established John could not have hired a contract killer, did not have accomplices, and could not have known the timing of his sister-in-law's and niece's trip. He was dismissed as a suspect. Hal was also considered a suspect because he had posted bail for his brother, knowing he had abused Michelle. Hal later said he had promised the family he would post bail and would not renege on his promise. Investigators from Florida and Ohio also discovered Hal had withdrawn $7,000 from his bank account at the time of the disappearance, which he was able to account for. He had planned to use it to look for his wife and daughters before he was notified of their deaths. Investigations proved conclusively Hal had not left Ohio during that period. The rape of Michelle Rogers and gossip by local police was one of the reasons for the Florida trip. Joan and her daughters wanted to distance themselves from the incident. Chandler's testimony at his trial in Clearwater, Florida. Chandler said he met Joan, Michelle, and Christy Rogers and gave them directions, but he never saw them again except in newspaper coverage and on billboards. He acknowledged he was on Tampa Bay that night. Police had evidence of three ship-to-shore telephone calls made from his boat to his home during the time frame of the murders, but Chandler maintained he was fishing alone. He said he had returned home late because his engine would not start, which he attributed to a gas line leak. He also said he had called the Coast Guard and the Florida Marine Patrol and had flagged down a patrol boat, but both were too busy to help. He said he subsequently fixed the line with duct tape and returned safely to shore. There were, however, no records of distress calls from Chandler to either the Coast Guard or the Marine Patrol that night, nor were there any Coast Guard boats on the bay the following morning that could have helped him. According to a boat mechanic who testified for the prosecution, Chandler's explanation of repairing the boat's alleged gas leak was not tenable because the fuel lines in his boat, a bay liner, were directed upward. A leak would have sprayed fuel into the air rather than into the boat, and the gasoline would have dissolved the adhesive of the duct tape Chandler maintained he had used to repair the purported leak. Under questioning from the Pinellas County prosecutor, Douglas Crow, Chandler then said he could not remember. A woman named Judy Blair testified that on May 15, 1989, 2 weeks before the Rogers murders, Chandler invited her onto his boat in nearby Madeira Beach for a boat trip on Tampa Bay, raped her, and then returned her to shore. Blair had been with his friend Barbara Mottram, who refused Chandler's offer to join them on the boat. After Judy was raped, she told the court she returned to her hotel room where Barbara was waiting. Chandler was not charged with this crime. Blair testified during Chandler's murder trial to establish his pattern of attack and to show the similarities between the two crimes. Blair stated that Chandler on May 14th had given his name as Dave Posner, or Dave Ponceau, when the three first met at a convenience store in Tampa. He told Blair and Mottram that he was in the aluminum siding contracting business, which later helped lead investigators to him. It also inspired the name of the investigation, Operation Tin Man. The facial composite produced from Blair's description was posted on the billboards along with the handwriting samples. A former employee of Chandler's testified that he bragged about dating three women on the bay on the night of the murders, and that the next morning he arrived by boat and delivered materials for a job and immediately set out again in an attempt to establish Chandler's whereabouts on that night. Investigators found records of several ship-to-shore telephone calls made from his boat to his home between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m., which may have been attempts to explain his absence to his wife and to prove himself with an alibi for the time of the murders. Chandler's daughter, Crystal May Sue, testified that her father had talked about killing three women and that he was afraid of returning to Tampa. A woman who worked as a maid at the Days Inn said she walked past Chandler on June 1st as she was going to the Rogers room for room service. She said she did not realize the significance of this sighting until Chandler's arrest in 1992. This sighting has never been confirmed. Michelle Rogers' boyfriend and Hal Rogers also gave evidence during the trial. Joan Michelle and Christy Rogers were buried in their hometown on June 13, 1989. After a funeral service attended by about 300 family members and friends. Numerous police officers were present to keep reporters and television crews out of the church during the service. Chandler was found guilty of the murders and was sentenced to death on November 4, 1994. He maintained his innocence and continued to pursue legal appeals while on Florida's death row. He admitted to the Madeira Beach incident, but said the sex was consensual, that the victim had changed her mind during the act. Because Chandler had already been sentenced to death for the Rogers murders, and because prosecutors did not want to subject Blair to the emotional trauma of a rape trial, he was never prosecuted for Blair's rape. Chandler awaited execution of his sentence at the Union Correctional Institution shortly after the trial and conviction. His wife Deborah filed for divorce and their marriage was formally dissolved a year later. Chandler was no longer allowed to see his daughter, Whitney, and in accordance with his ex-wife's wishes, he was not allowed to see later photographs of her. In July 2008, Chandler was on Florida's shortlist of executions. Profiling experts speculated Chandler may have killed previously, based on the belief that a first-time killer would not be experienced or bold enough to abduct and kill three women at once. Chandler remained a suspect in the 1982 murder of a woman whose body was found floating off Anna Maria Island until 2011, when the body was identified as 29-year-old Amy Hurst, and her husband was arrested and charged with her murder. Chandler was never charged with another murder. All of his appeals of his 1994 conviction were denied. His last was in May of 2007. So it sounded like he kind of had a pattern, kind of had a thing going on there.
There's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
Because, like, the mom and her daughters were, like, the whole reason for getting away, that's really horrific. There was a whole nother thing that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, at one point, I think you had said that he had told his daughter he murdered three people.
That's what the daughter testified. Yeah.
Like, who would tell their daughter that? Not saying that she's lying.
No.
What I think is even more horrific, I think he probably did. You know, like, that would, I can't imagine.
Then what do you do as the child with that information?
Each. You
know, how do you process it? How do you, I mean.
You know, I don't know how old she was at the time, but I don't think too old.
Yeah, I mean, if you're if it's one thing if you're an adult or you're of an age where you can go, okay, something's got to be reported. But if you're just a little kid and you hear that, you're like, okay, I like dominoes. You know, it's like you don't know what, you know, you did what? You killed three, you know. And it makes you wonder a little because I don't know the age of what she was at the time, but I wonder if that was something where he was, you know, feeling like he could say this to a child because what's a child going to do? And he wanted to get it off his chest, I wonder. And that was one of the
poor mom just takes the kids to Florida to escape all of that stuff. And then look what happens. Like, it's just so tragic all the way around. You know, and the fact that they thought originally she got lost, maybe asked him for directions or something.
Oh.
Just a random meeting. I think that's so bizarre. When you think about all the places and the people in the world, and you have to be at that exact same spot at the exact time that person's there.
Because
it wasn't like he had been stalking them. It was a random meeting.
It sounded like he had found some success, though, in this approach of talking to random women and going, hey, come on out of my boat. randomly.
But, I mean, the fact that they just happened to be there right then. Yeah. Or the other woman who he raped.
Yeah.
It was just a random encounter. I just,
It's just fucked up.
It seems like life is just so cruel and unfair. When you think about it like that, like, they were just going on vacation and they were probably having a pretty good time.
Mm-hmm. And then they met Oba.
Yeah.
Continuing on with his story. After his conviction, Chandler was named by media as one of Florida's most notorious criminals. He said his last words before his execution would be, "Kiss my rosy red ass," in May 2011. Comparisons were drawn between Chandler's case and trial. In 1994, in the murder case of Kaylee Anthony, in both cases, heightened media attention forced the selection of jurors who lived outside the county where the crime had been committed. One of the jurors in Chandler's 1994 trial said he scared some of the jurors when he would sit there and stare at you and have that stupid grin on his face. He'd make your skin crawl. Judge Susan F. Schaefer, who presided over the 1994 trial and ultimately sentenced Chandler, described him in a 2011 interview as a man with no soul. She said it's the worst case as far as factually and as far as a defendant without saving grace that I ever handled. And I represented plenty of people who were not necessarily good people. On October 10th, 2011, Governor Rick Scott signed Chandler's death warrant. His execution was set for November 15, 2011 at 4 p.m. His lawyer, Vea Harrison, said Chandler asked him not to file any frivolous appeals to keep him alive. Harrison said, "He's not putting a lot of pressure on me to go running around at the end to find some magic way out. He's not going to make a scene. He's not going to bemoan the legal system. What he has told me is this. If there's some legal way that I can find to try to prevent him from being executed, he would like me to do what I reasonably can." Harrison also said Chandler suffered from high blood pressure, coronary artery disease, problems with his kidneys, and arthritis. On October 12, 2011, Harrison said, although he was preparing to file a motion regarding the violation of his client's Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment rights in the case, he was unsure whether Chandler was willing to travel to Clearwater for the court hearing or would agree to filing of the motion. He hates coming down to Clearwater. He doesn't like the ride, and he's not well. Harrison said on October 18th, Harrison filed a motion against the execution on grounds that the way Florida imposes the death penalty is unconstitutional. A jury may recommend a life sentence or a death sentence, but under Florida law, the judge makes the final decision. A hearing on Chandler's motion was set for October 21st at 1 p.m. Chandler did not attend. On October 24th, Chandler's appeal was rejected because he had already filed an appeal to the Florida Supreme Court prior to the decision. This appeal was heard in a court in Tallahassee at 9 a.m. on November 9th, 2011. The Florida Supreme Court had upheld Chandler's death sentence in 1997 and 2003. On November 15th, Chandler was executed at 4:08 p.m. at Florida State Prison in Rayford. Chandler decided to make a last statement before being executed, but left a written statement with prison officials. "You are killing an innocent man today." Shortly after signing Chandler's death warrant, Governor Scott said, "Chandler killed three women, so I looked through different cases and it made sense to do that one. There's never one thing. It was the right case." Chandler's daughter, Valerie Troxell, said in an interview after the execution, "I believe they did execute an innocent man. I don't think my father alone could have pulled off such a heinous crime. It would have to have been more than one person. The palm print would prove he did meet them and gave them directions, but it didn't mean he killed them. I think the prosecution had a very weak case." Troxell also said she had sent a letter to Governor Scott asking him to commute Chandler's sentence to life imprisonment. Chandler's son, Jeff, said, "I truly believe he was tried and convicted by the media long before he went to trial. The media can pretty much convict you. I don't think he got a fair trial." After his execution, Chandler was described as the loneliest man in the loneliest place on earth, death row. He did not receive a single visitor during his years in Florida's death row unit. Another of Chandler's daughters, named Suzette, said her father was a monster who got what he deserved. Coral Springs murder. On February 25th, 2014, investigators revealed DNA evidence identified Chandler as the murderer of Ivalice Burrows, who was raped and strangled in Coral Springs, Florida, on November 27th, 1990. Chandler was living 2 miles from her workplace and abandoned his apartment 2 days after murdering her, leaving everything, including his furniture, behind. Burrows, a 20-year-old newlywed, was last seen at Sawgrass Mills Mall, where she worked at a sporting goods store. When she did not return home, her husband went to the mall and found her car, a 1985 Ford Tempo, with the tires slashed. It is believed Chandler, after watching the victim for 2 days, slashed the tires, arrived in the guise of a helpful stranger, and offered to help. 3 hours after she was reported missing, her body was found under a residential mailbox in a local neighborhood by 2 men returning from a fishing trip. Burrows' body was naked and had marks on both wrists and legs, and brown tape stuck to her hair. The case is considered solved and closed, according to police. Law enforcement agencies across Florida investigated other cold cases in areas Chandler was known to have resided. No more convictions have arisen since. Sounds like a lovely individual. Just the type of guy you want doing your aluminum siding.
But he's unlicensed.
Yeah.
So the DNA definitely tied him to the one case, but with the women in the water, there's no way they could, like, there's not going to be any direct DNA there.
No.
But, so if I had, like, I'm defending my dad, he didn't do it, then you find out he did that one, I think I might think he did the other ones.
Or your dad has a fancy for taking women out on boats and raping them. Might be a possible murderer too. If
I mean, how would you feel? Yeah. Like, because I think as a child, you know, if that's your parent, the last thing you want to believe is that your parent is capable of something like that, because
sure,
you've got the same DNA, similar DNA, and you don't want that to be true.
No.
You don't want to come from someone like that. But if you're faced with the science of it,
yeah.
I don't know. Like, if he could do that, I'd be like, well, put him to death for that then, because he did that one.
Some people have an amazing ability to deny reality to such extremes. And I think that's the only way that it explains.
The other kid, I think you said it was a daughter, said he was a horrible person.
Yeah.
I'm with that daughter.
Yeah. I think it's pretty clear cut and dry. I had not read this whole story in advance of recording the episode, other than just kind of the intro to it. So I was curious, because I knew that he had denied it up until death, but after hearing the whole thing and hearing his tendencies, hearing his pattern of behavior and other people right, saying what he's done, yeah, I mean, it's no wonder. It's not the media that I think set him up and said he did this. It's like, look, you have all these women who claim that you went out on a boat and raped them. And
here's the other thing about the 3 women.
Yeah.
2 of them are children. I don't know how old they were. I don't remember. But they're younger.
Yeah.
With a mom. If you had a gun and you're threatening, like, you've got the gun pointed at one of the kids, yeah, the other two are going to do anything you tell them to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. And where can they go?
Yeah.
Yeah, I could jump off the boat and leave my 2 daughters there. I could jump off the boat, leave my mom and my sister. Like, no, you can't. You're on a boat.
Yeah.
And if that person's armed, and chances are he was, I don't think you need a second person.
Yeah. I think there would have been many ways that he could have pulled that off by himself. You wouldn't want to think a person could, and think that's what hangs up, especially the family, like you were saying. But in reality, yeah, I mean,
you're on a boat. Where can you go?
He could have had them tie the stuff around themselves,
exactly,
with a gun pointed at them and saying, do this or I'm going to shoot you. And at that point, you're like, well, what are my options? You know, and you're hoping
you can't. Like, as the mom, you can't jump and try to swim away.
No.
Where are you going to go? It's dark.
he had a system, and he obviously got some sort of joy out of this, but a sick individual. There you go. That's the fun-loving unicorn rainbow story of...
We talked about it last week about, you know, I'm not a big proponent of the death penalty.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can get it wrong.
Uh-huh.
But then there's times I'm like, good.
Yeah,
I hope that doesn't make me a horrible person.
I think the more we do this show, the more you're going to be like, okay, I'm cool with it.
But I think it has to be in the right...
Yeah.
Like, you know, you have to know. You want to know that the evidence is there.
Yeah.
I would hate to see an innocent person...
It can't
even
be
imprisoned, but because that's just horrific. And it happens all the time, which really bugs me.
Sure.
But guys like this, if he was still out, you know, and like he would just be killing more people and raping more people.
In many cases, it is the right call. And I would say on this one, you know, probably definitely the right call in the dark case of Oba Chandler. That's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our program, please leave us a positive review over there on Apple Podcasts. We'd greatly appreciate that. Send me a screenshot of that. Send it to review at darksideofwiki and darksideofwiki.com. And I'll put you into a drawing for a $200 Amazon gift card. We'll be picking that winner shortly. Just leave that review of what you think of the show. Send me the screenshot, review at darksideofwiki. You'll be in that drawing. Press subscribe. Let your friends know that we exist. Until next time, for Carol Hughes, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening to The Dark Side of Wikipedia.